And now,
the definition. Definition.
Shades of political opinion. One of the shadiest of these is the liberals. An outspoken group on many subjects. 10 degrees to the left of center in good times. 10 degrees to the right of center if it affects them personally. So here then is a lesson in safe logic. I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. And I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy, as though I'd lost a father of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Get it? I go to civil rights rallies, and I put down the old D.A.R. D.A.R., that's the Dykes of the American Revolution. I love Harry and Sidney and Sammy. I hope every colored boy becomes a star. But don't talk about revolution. That's going a little bit too far. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I cheered when Humphrey was chosen, my faith in the system restored. And I'm glad that the commies were thrown out from the AFL-CIO board. And I love Puerto Ricans and Negroes as long as they don't move next door. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Ah, the people of old Mississippi should all hang their heads in shame. Now I can't understand how their minds work. What's the matter? Don't they watch Les Crane? But if you ask me to bust my children, I hope the cops take down your name. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Yes, I read New Republic and Nation. I've learned to take every view. You know, I've memorized Lerner and Golden. I feel like I'm almost a Jew. But when it comes to times like Korea, there's no one more red, white, and blue. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. I vote for the Democratic Party. They want the UN to be strong. I attend all the Pete Seeger concerts. He sure gets me singing those songs. And I'll send all the money you ask for. But don't ask me to come on along. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Sure, once I was young and impulsive. I wore every conceivable pin. Even went to socialist meetings. Learned all the old union hymns. Ah, but I've grown older and wiser. And that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation.
She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is your brother, Vladimir Deese. Welcome to another episode of the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Woo! Man, end of the year is coming up quick. And I wasn't certain if I would get this one done and out, but it's done. And it's out. I'm calling this my anti-intellectual show or episode because it really is about being anti-intellectual a little bit. I was thinking this week about all of these wonderful little philosophical concepts that create and manipulate and label our political system. And there's a lot of them now. There's tons of them now. It's gotten to the point where there are so many different labels that I've become confused. Because a libertarian is not a neoconservative, yet holds many neoconservative values. Yet they believe, and they state constantly, that they are more liberal in their social perspective. I haven't seen it. But okay. And then there's this idea of what's really actually a fascist. We live in very strange times. There used to be a channel on YouTube, and I'm kind of mad at myself because I used to follow it, but I didn't really grab a lot of the videos from it. And it was a weird video collection because the guy actually was a fascist. He openly admitted it. He was supposedly a black guy. I say supposedly because he somewhat sounded like one, but never really put his face out to confirm it. But he did extensive research, and he would list books. He would talk about books intimately that were written by self-avowed fascists. It was quite interesting to actually listen to some of his stuff. It was also a little bit maddening because he was trying to make fascism look colorful and beautiful and as if it is something that the United States of America should be actively and consciously aiming towards, fulfilling. I don't know about the actively and consciously part, but I think America is pretty much in line to fulfill that destiny. So, this confusion, and it really is. It's utter confusion of all of these labels. Really comes out of the inability of this society to deal with the consequences and emergencies that were left to deal with after World War II, pretty much exploded colonization, forcing Western European and Anglo countries to liquidate themselves of their properties and of the peoples, to an extent, of course. And specifically in the United States, it forced the country to deal with, on some level, the question of race. Yes, it always comes back to race, because race, colonialism, economics, all of it is the same. And the ironic thing about it is, for most of the people who consider themselves white in this country, if you do the research, and many of you have never done the research, the sad thing is, it's available widely now. It's not even hard to get. Most of you are considered mongrels. You aren't even considered white. They have played with your mind and given you a false sense of superiority that you don't even get. You don't even understand how much they have played with your mind. You think you are so much better than you actually are in their eyes. And they'll tell you that if you press them enough. But as a response to trying to deal with the problems that World War II kind of forced upon this country, you had a lot of big corporations, and I imagine, even though the history hasn't been written yet, or as of yet, I think you had a lot of royalty and the nobility that surrounds the royalty, which kind of is the power behind the power behind the power. You had this group of people who have enormous sway over a country's direction, who can build a country spirit, not a soul. Soul is something different. You get that when you're born. Some countries get it when they're born. Some of them have to earn it. The United States had to earn theirs, but that's a different story. They could build the spirit of a country and therefore impregnate every being and every person and every human and every man, every woman, womb, man, born here. They can impregnate them with this spirit and therefore give them a overview of their life, the structure of their life. It's like being born, if you were born in a prison with different levels of coexistence within that prison, and you were raised in that prison, you would think that's how the world was. Now, the world isn't like a prison. The United States, as I keep hearing people, you know, who leave and come back and they're telling their stories, the United States may kind of be like a prison. We are kind of a little bit shut off from the rest of the world. We don't actually understand the world as much as we think we do, and we don't influence the world as much as we think we do either. Culturally, the West of Europe, absolutely. But we don't influence the world as much as we think we do. But that's, again, another story, another day. So these people created a new spirit for the country. If you watch the 5-part documentary, Century of Self, that gives you a great, great overview of what they created. And it didn't just start in the aftermath of World War II. They were already laying some of this down. It was just after World War II to kind of prevent another depression, or that's how at least it's been spun. They went to work with building the spirit of the country, which was going to be consumeristic. Now, a hyper-consumption spirit is very short-sighted, tremendously short-sighted. short-sighted, especially if you're not building in systemic cycles where you can take a product which is conceived, utilize it to the fullest extent in which it'll go, and then recycle it so you can use as much as possible from that product to build new products. If you don't do that, then you're essentially setting yourself up to exhaust those minerals and those sources from the planet. And I desperately try not to say resources, because it automatically says to the planet that everything that is created naturally is to be utilized without any malice, or not malice, without any consideration to how it's going to actually impact not only this generation, but future generations. When you build a spirit, people say culture, but it's really, you're building a spirit for your country, which is hyperly consumeristic. You are then also setting yourself up to consume your own people. Because then, if the people are being asked to consume everything within the planet, and then the corporations are being asked to continuously generate products that consume everything from the planet and then feed it to every person, ultimately, the corporation is going to have to, sooner rather than later, start approaching the people who work for them as just little itty-bitty parts that can be changed in and out. Why? Because ultimately, the corporation is the thing that's is the gears. It's just the gears. And so it doesn't have any time to consider whether or not this is good or this is bad. Is this going to be helpful or is this going to be harmful? It must keep grinding along. And so when one little piece doesn't fit and doesn't enable it to keep grinding along, get rid of it. Thump. Put in somebody else. In other words, when you create a consumeristic spirit, which says, okay, we're going to just consume everything nature has for the benefit of just more consumption, you will start to consume people as well. And so then people become consumer products. They stop being consumers and they become consumer products. So first they're consumer products for the corporations, and then they are consumer products for each other. And we are actually in a dramatically disgusting phase of that right now. So, in a response to building, you know, to going through that process of wanting to build this new spirit, and, you know, to be fair, this was kind of always to be expected. America was always consumer happy, or at least the elite was. The upper echelon has always been. So it was going to happen sooner or later that they were going to spread that sickness to everybody else. Unless they were checked. And they weren't going to be checked. So as they were building this spirit, what did they do? They had to infest, literally infest, the college campuses to make them put this new spirit onto a new generation. And really, the 80s generation, A Century of Self makes a good argument that the baby boomers who came of age during the 60s and the 70s was really the first generation where this was implemented. And I think it's a great point. Because then, you know, after all of the radical fights in the 70s had pretty much been quelled and cooled down by the beginning of the 80s, you had a new turn of events, which was called pop music. Not in the sense of, oh, well, just let's snap our bubblegum to it. No. I like to say pop music was, it was brain-popping music. Where you listen to it, you got no kind of, well, some of it you got some social message. But you got really no spiritual benefit from it, but it encouraged you to be a consumer, to rethink, in often detrimental ways, but to rethink old traditions. It really separated you from the past. Now, in the 80s, there was a little bit of a leaning towards the past when it came to pop music, but still, for the most part, it was about separating you from earlier musical styles and forcing those forcing new musical styles onto a new generation. All of these labels kind of started coming into vogue during that same period of time. And many of the labels had maybe one or two, three books written, sometimes less, on the importance of the labels, the meaning of the labels, the philosophy behind the labels, all of this other stuff. Some of them had extensive libraries, which basically still gave it no credibility, but still had extensive libraries on the meaning of it. But many of these labels just, they don't matter in the grand scheme of things. And in fact, if we were to take away the philosophy, and this is actually the primary argument of this show, if you take away the philosophy of the majority of this stuff, and you analyze what is actually and realistically seen, what is actually done, what you would notice is half, if not three-fourths of these labels would go away overnight, because the majority of them are just relabeling something that already exists. So if you start, for instance, with socialism, which, by the way, is a primitive concept in most economic thinking. You know, they mention Sweden and such. But before Sweden, socialism, the reason why the elite fought against socialism was because they connected socialism with the primitives, with the indigenous groups, with some parts of Africa. It was considered a primitive concept, so it couldn't be utilized in the civilized world, as they would say. That's why they hated it so much. It wasn't about the fact, well, part of it was indeed about the fact of them having to share their vast wealth, but they looked at it as belonging to a bunch of savages who couldn't be civilized and who had in fact lost the right to be civilized by losing to white people in many instances. So if you take something like socialism, you take something like liberalism, which actually has a well-grounded, somewhat grounded, philosophical underpinning, which is somewhat similar to conservatism. Then you have conservatism, which in England, there's actually greater difference between conservatives and liberals than there are over here. Then you have labor, which is an entirely different concept than both conservatism and liberalism. If you take these four concepts, you add to it authoritarianism, which totalitarianism is just a branch from. So now you have five. You take fascism, which truthfully is something of its own making. Now you have six. And even of those six, really only three of them are true social political structures. So you can structure a country, all of its branches, using these three. And that would be socialism, fascism, and authoritarianism. Authoritarianism, you would get monarchical monarchs ruling, so that would be within them. With socialism, you would also get communism, even though many people would say communism is ahead of socialism, but socialism is actually the branch from which communism comes off of. Or actually, it's more like the trunk that communism comes off. But I'm nuancing right now. Liberalism is a philosophy. Conservatism is a philosophy. Progressivism, to the extent that you can really consider it, is a philosophy. And I do mean that. I just don't see any difference between moderates and progressivism and progressives. It's not anything real different. Labor would be considered in the United States dramatically radical. Just horribly, horribly radical. Anarchy, which gets, again, a bad, just absolutely horrible reputation today, is not the crap you see with Black Bloc. These people aren't anarchists. Most of them are probably paid government, forget about informants. They're just paid government stooges that run around acting like idiots. But that's not anarchy. This is how worrisome anarchy is to the elite. You will find it difficult to find Mother Jones writing, which I don't think Mother Jones was technically, who am I thinking about? Not Mother Jones. Mother Jones, you can find some of her writings. Emma Goldman, I think is her name. It is difficult to find her stuff, and she was a brilliant writer, but she was an anarchist. She might have been a socialist, but I think she also was a anarchist too. Because I have some of her writings. Actually, there's a great collection on LibriVox, LibriVox.org, of her writings, which truthfully, anybody who wants to talk about anything, who wants to really think about economics in a new way, they should go to LibriVox, get that collection, and just listen to it. Let your brain absorb it over the next few months, the next year. Just listen to it over and over again. And I mean it. And I mean it. The reason why I say listen to it over and over again is because when you listen to it once, your brain, a lot of people say, oh, well, I remember it. That's not the reason why you listen to it again, though. Because the brain is just one part of your body. The brain could absorb it, but it doesn't go past your brain. See, you start listening to it over and over again. It's like a good song. When you listen to it over and over again, your body gets into the mood. Your body gets into the rhythm. And that's why you want to listen to this stuff over and over again, because it changes your physiological structure. Using all these big words. It's late, ladies and gentlemen. Very late. And I'm using these big words. So pardon me if some of them are not coming out right. Plus, I just got done eating. That's another thing. So do that. I mean, absolutely do that. And the reason I'm saying this is, ladies and gentlemen, I'm getting to the anti-intellectual part because there is a bit more. But I am having a difficult time presently with a lot of white folks because they're just, it's letting me down so much that so many of them, it's you can't reach them. They're committed to just killing the entire species. And if we are going to save ourselves, we have to start reaching back to those roots of radicalism and resurrecting true change for this country. Because if we don't, I'm just fearful of where this country's going. Because there's a stench that I thought I would never, ever in my life smell again. And it really is of not only fascism, but horrible, horrible disease of murdering. And I'm concerned about all that. I really am. Now, the anti-intellectual part, the reason why I call this an anti-intellectual episode is because we have thought ourselves into stupidity. People, a lot of philosophers, really, truthfully believe that they're writing things that are going to help people. And a lot of the stuff they're writing ain't going to help nobody. And a lot of them, you know, I've listened to a brother named Tommy Curry, Dr. Tommy Curry. Let me get that straight. He is a doctorate, Tommy Curry. And he says, and he has said, he says, look, there's people who sit in the classroom and academia and they write. And their writings, though good, have no bearing to reality. And this is most of this is the problem. Because if we are to be truthful, if we are to be 100% truthful, we need real solutions. And the solutions that we need ain't coming from conservatism, ain't coming from liberalism. The only thing that's going to move anything in this country will have to come from a radical grab bag. And everybody knows it. Liberalism is out of, it's dead. It's literally, figuratively, metaphorically, it is dead. You basically buried it when you buried John Kennedy. That is how dead it is. If you were to dig John Kennedy up and put his body on display, it'd probably smell to holy hell, but that's how dead liberalism is. And conservatism, and first and foremost, conservatives know that liberalism is dead. That's why they've been able to gain so much traction. Because they know liberalism is dead. In conservatism, they knew that liberalism was dead. To the point that they were concerned about what came after it. When John Kennedy was killed, ladies and gentlemen, and it took me a long time to get this, when John Kennedy was killed, that was essentially a changing of the guard when it came to political ideologies. That was them saying, liberalism has run its course. We are not doing that anymore. We are not doing that anymore. And they knew this. I actually think they knew this in the 50s, which is one of the reasons why they started going after radicals. That's why they started going after radicals, because they knew liberalism was dead, and they understood it because of FDR. FDR, when he died, I still say when he's murdered, but people say, you know, he died because the office ran him down, basically, and he was sick and yada yada yada. Read his second Bill of Rights. That was 100% socialist. And they made him get rid of his former vice president before he ran in 44, because they expected him to be dead by the time 48 came around. They expected him to be dead by the time 48 came around. And he was dead. He was dead. I don't believe he saw the end of World War II, if memory serves me correctly. And then you got Truman. Then you got Truman. Instead of, I think his running mate was Wallace, maybe. And Wallace was a left liberal. If that's his name, if I'm remembering it correctly. But whoever his running mate was before Truman, he was a left liberal. He was so left, he was practically a damn socialist. That's how left that man was. At least that was the rumors. And in fact, he ran for president afterwards, and I think he was actually a socialist. He ran as a socialist. But they knew that liberalism was done. And so when Kennedy was elected, because you had Truman, the great betrayer of the common man. Interesting that his name was Truman, right? And he was a false man. And then you had Eisenhower, the great war hero, who was going to win anyway. And then you had Kennedy. And Kennedy was a throwback. Kennedy was a throwback. And the country, particularly the elite, was in a moment of flux. And they were not trying to hear a lot of what Kennedy was saying. Now look, Kennedy was no radical liberal. But Kennedy did not believe, in many instances, not in all, that some of the post-war structures, the infrastructure that had kind of gone up, the military, intelligence, and stuff, he didn't believe it should be where it was at. And so he went after them. And that was a conservative liberal position. But he also believed in a more just world, even if he didn't always act on it. And that was frightening for these people. And again, when he was shot and he was killed, it was determined basically by these people that that form of liberalism that he kind of represented would never get into the White House again. They thought LBJ was going to be sort of more conservative. And in many instances, he was. But in many instances, he was not. So although I say it died with Kennedy, LBJ was probably the last majorly liberal of that generation type that was ever in office. So maybe you can actually go and dig him up and throw him up and, you know, that stench will be the death of liberalism. But then we have conservatism. Conservatism is an even deader philosophy. Because it doesn't really do anything but degrade your society to the point where you think you're moving towards something, but you're actually degrading into something. That's the major mistake that most conservatives, and may I say most progressives, make. They keep saying, oh, well, we're not heading towards anything. The radicals had the idea for a very brief moment of true transformative integration into a commonwealth society, into a common unity society. They had that. Conservatives, all they want is the past to be the present, and you cannot do that. I don't care how much you put your heels into the dirt. Time is always progressive. And this maybe is the funny thing about progressivism, is how progressivism is so fundamentally linked to conservatism. Because progressivism doesn't really give you anywhere to go. It doesn't really give you a vision. Though it says things which makes you believe it's giving you a vision, but it's not. Progressivism takes from all of these different ideologies. And truthfully, I mean it. If you ever listen to progressives, and most of you probably who listen to this are consider yourselves progressives, but think about it. Outside of all the crazy, loony nuttiness that conservatives do, there's actually three or four things that conservatives say that you'd be like, yeah, I can get behind that, right? Because that's a progressive. And most of you will admit that. You'll say, yeah, we take from everybody. But that's the problem. There's no clear-cut direction because you get caught up with all of these different ideologies. Socialism has undertones of conservatism, of fiscal conservatism. But overall, it's a very distinct vision. The same with communism. The same with anarchism. Same with capitalism. Progressivism, as it exists presently, is a capitalist engine. It's a capitalist philosophy, and I say engine because it does. It kind of feeds capitalism. It sucks some energy off, but then it just feeds capitalism. And so its ultimate vision is capitalism. Wherever capitalism wants to go, well, we want to improve it a little bit, but we still want to go to capitalism. We'll take from conservatism, we'll take from liberalism, we'll even borrow a little bit from socialism just to kind of, you know, we're different that way, but we still want capitalism. The problem with capitalism is a philosophical argument made in the 1800s, built off of stuff that was true in the 1700s and 1600s. Capitalism transformed itself into neoliberalism. Neocolonialism is all it is. Neocorporatism, neo-fascism, which is all that is. And truthfully, it transforms itself and degrades itself into fascism. Why? Because capitalism is fundamentally a destructive and disintegrating force. This is what it does. I'm not talking philosophically. I don't care about that. I am saying when you look at what it does, it disintegrates people. And this is something I gotta give some shout out to. Chris Hedges, I was reading one of his articles a couple of weeks ago on Truthdig. And I just happened to come across it again earlier today, and I was reading it. But it does, it disintegrates people. It disintegrates societies. It disintegrates entire nations. That's what it does. And so the philosophical underpinnings, of capitalism, of being this great stabilizer and equalizer of opportunities and building great societies, you know, of morality and trust and a great companion to democracy. If you ask any real, honest, and I remember this from Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story. If you ask any real, honest Wall Streeter, banker, what have you, you know what they're going to tell you? No, capitalism is a horrible companion to democracy because democracy is problematic to capitalism. Democracy is dramatically problematic to capitalism. And may I just point out, which is, it's, there's an irony to this, but no one's actually talked about it. Is democracy in and of itself an economic idea? Is there an ideology of democracy which can not only apply to the political realm, but also to the judicial realm, to the executive realm, the legislative realm, to the economic realm, the cultural realm, the academia realm? Is democracy compatible with so many systems where it actually should be considered its own political, economic, ideological form? I don't know. It's a question, though. Because we talk about socialism. We talk about communism. We talk about anarchism. We talk about capitalism and fascism. And in all of these things, we always mention democracy kind of in passing. Some have more of it. Some have less of it. Well, here's the thing. Is it possible that Everyone wants democracy. Is it possible that we have been skipping over the truest solution to all of this? Everyone wants democracy. Well, is it possible that you can put democracy as its own ideological force? And that you can actually build entire societies just from the democracy philosophy? And I hate that word philosophy because it just doesn't fit for me. But is it possible that we've just missed that? I think it is. I think it is. So, you know, some of you may be wondering, you know, I haven't really attacked intellectuals. But some people get a little bit beside themselves when you start talking about getting rid of philosophies, tearing up philosophies, you know, that philosophies have no real basis. The reason why I say it's anti-intellectual, again, it's late, ladies and gentlemen, so I apologize. The reason I say that is because of the quagmire we find ourselves in. We are no longer analyzing things. Not from just pure thought and reason. Some of us are still doing that. But challenging the society to better itself. I want you to think about this, ladies and gentlemen. Most of you know that China is on the ascendant. But do most of you really know why China is considered on the ascendant? There is a couple of things that Donald Trump said during his campaign, which I truthfully war for. One such thing one statement he made, was he wanted to have better relations with all of these countries. And he talked about going to these countries to talk about trade deals that would be beneficial for the United States and for the people of those countries. And he was ridiculed for that. He was ridiculed for that. This is what China is doing. China isn't saying, I'm going to, a couple of countries they've done that. But China isn't going to every country and saying, hey, give us what we want or we're going to send our military to beat the hell out of you. That's what the U.S. is doing. This country needs better relationships with other countries. When you look at what China is doing, and ladies and gentlemen, go Google the images, the information about China's modern cities. It is horrible and horrifying in comparison to this country. A point that Barack Obama used to make, the United States has zero bullet trains. Zero bullet trains. China has several. 300 miles per hour. Boom. America has none. None. And we can't even get one. I live in Central New York. There was talk for 10 years about, I'm trying to remember if it was high speed. I want to say it was a high speed rail connection from Buffalo to Rochester to Syracuse to Albany to New York City. You could get to New York City in under 3 hours, I believe it was, or maybe it was about 3 hours, from Buffalo. That was high-speed rail. Get it done. But we can't even do that. Oh, well, there's no political capital. There's no political will. Bull crap. You don't need political will to do that because what they're actually saying is there's no money for it. No, There's tons of money for it. It's just a bunch of people are being freaking greedy. The United States is dying because it has bought into its own nonsense. And this is something that we have to do something about. All of these labels, most of them don't even matter. If we are really going to save ourselves, we need to get beyond those labels. We not only need to get beyond those labels, but we need to describe the ones that we have in realistic terms, and we need to do it quick. And then make plans for the future. It's going to be up to the millennials. I'm actually, that's weird for me to say, I'm a millennial. And I see the problem. And I'll tell you part of the problem with millennials. If you are over the age of 30 right now, tell me if you don't remember this. Your parents would say to you, don't get in trouble. They might tell you to stand up for people. But they will say, don't get in trouble. Don't get in trouble. Don't ruin your life. Don't get in trouble. Think about that. Don't get in trouble. Many of us was groomed on that. Don't get in trouble. Now, we may also be told to stand up for people's rights. We may also be brought to protests and what have you. But don't get in trouble limits us. It limits us. Along with the, try not to swear on this one, because it's just bull-s. That whole idea of if you get in trouble 6 months from now, or in the next 6 months, then, you know, it's going to add some weight to your sentence. See, that's one of those rules they adopted after the 60s to stop people from protesting. But it's going to be up to us. We are going to have to do this. The sad part about it is, many of you have been hypnotized, and you don't even realize it. They have inserted into your minds wedges. They talk about wedge groups, wedge issues, things like that. Really, really research those. Wedge groups, wedge issues. They have put wedge items in your mind. One of those wedges is the race card. And the inability to see racism in its truest forms without wanting to get to the point where you're saying, oh, you're just playing the race card. That's what they've done. They've done that to you. They've also put wedges in you according to what political ideology you belong to. So, for instance, you're progressive. Conservatives are crazy. What? Conservatives don't think that much. What? You're conservatives. You're a conservative. Oh, liberals want to destroy the country. What? Liberals hate blah, 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 blah. What? Think about it. How stupid is that? They got you fighting a group of people based on the words, often, of people who are making so much money that many of them each day are making more than you are making in a year. I'm not joking. I like she's okay, Rachel Maddow. But Rachel Maddow gets paid. Same thing with Rush Limbaugh. I love it. I had to say to a friend of mine a couple of years ago, when he was, you know, quoting Rush Limbaugh to me, another girl that I know, she's very quick to tell me she's half black, half white, but she looks white. But I had to tell both of them when they were quoting Rush Limbaugh to me. I said, wait a minute, why are you quoting this dumbass who is making like 12, 13, 14, 15, I think it was making $10 million a year that time. Like, you're working a job that is paying you each year less than what he is bringing in each day. Okay, maybe it wasn't each day. I think it was each week at that time. Yeah, I keep saying each day. But I think it's each week. But you get the point. So I'm sorry about that. That's, you know, got to get those numbers right. But they said, so what does it matter? And I said, well, think about it. What do you mean, what doesn't matter? They're paying these people this much money. And you don't maybe think they have an incentive to do so? What kind of incentive? My head almost exploded. It's like, what do you freaking mean, what kind of incentive? Why aren't they... Okay, let me ask you this. And I asked a good friend of mine this too, you know, conservative guy. I said, let me ask you this. Why aren't they paying socialists? Oh, well, they're paying... And he started listing MSNBC people, and I laughed and said, please, please, please. Delusional. Just because Rush Limbaugh says they're socialist, don't mean they're socialist. Go and read socialist literature before you give me that nonsense. But honestly, why aren't they paying self-avowed, I'm talking about redistributing everything that you earn, big businessman, why aren't they paying those people? He, you know, he went and lapsed into the whole, oh, well, it's MSNBC, they're full of socialists. Had to leave him alone after that. But you get the point. You get the point. They're paying them to keep you occupied. I'm going to make this final point, and then I'm going to close up the show. We always hear everyone saying, join the conversation. Join the conversation. Join the conversation. I have a question then for all of you. When are we going to finally graduate from having a damn conversation in this country to actuating real solutions? People used to say something like, be the solution. What the hell do you mean, be the solution? Solutions often take multiple people at multiple levels to make happen. What are you talking about? Be the solution. Be part of the solution. Absolutely. Okay, tell me where I can meet the people who are going to be the solution, because I'll do it. You're a great example, a great example, a great example, a great example of this in action. The community that I grew up in, all my life, had this beautiful wooden playground. It was beautiful. It was really awesome. I mean, I spent so much time there as a kid and as a preteen. You know, it was insane. But it was beautiful. And it looked very unique. I mean, there was a huge swing set that was wooden. and these huge car chains used to hang down from it, and you can swing on it, and it had these slides and stuff, but it was all wooden. There was a stage with seating. It was awesome. It was great. They tore it down a couple of years after I graduated and put up a completely new plastic one, but don't really care about that part of the story. Here's the thing. I didn't wonder until I was probably about 8 or 9 where it came from, and so I asked the teacher, and the teacher said, oh, you know, a long time ago, people built it. Okay, whatever. That was in the 90s. Well, I was working at the local community center, and lo and behold, like a couple of weeks before I had started, they found all these old pictures, and they had framed them all and put them up on the wall. Among those pictures was a plethora, a huge amount of photos documenting the building of that playground. So for the first time in my life, I think it was in 81 when they built it. So literally about a year before I was born. But for the first time, I got to see what the plot looked like before they built it. I got to see all of the people come out to actually erect it. It took several days to do that. And a ton of people from all throughout the town came out to build it. When I say, when are we going to graduate from joining conversations to actuating solutions, I am specifically talking about that which occurred with that playground. There was a conversation, absolutely, ladies and gentlemen. There was a conversation. People said, well, the kids need a playground. Okay. What needs to happen to make it so? All right. Let's write down what needs to happen. There's the conversation. We have a conversation about what needs to happen. Boom. Do we have a plan associated with what needs to happen? Okay, that's the next conversation. You see, there's actually steps in this conversation. It's not just one extended conversation. There's steps in it. Okay, so now we have a plan to make what needs to be done a reality. Okay, so now where are we going to get the supplies at? Where are we going to get the manpower at? Where are we going to get the, when are we going to place this? These are all other conversations. So boom. Okay, now we get all that done. Okay, so now we've had 3 conversations. There were probably multiple conversations within those conversations, but let's just say each step is a conversation. But there's a solution. We already have the solution. So now we're actuating it. Actuating it. Actuating it is actualizing it. Realizing it, bringing it into reality, but we are actuating it because we are acting upon it. We are acting upon it. Acting upon it. I love that 3 thing. Actuating, acting upon it, actuating, acting upon it, actuating, acting upon it. Boom. So that's what we're doing. So we've had 3 conversations. All right, so now we got to get stuff together. Let's get everything together. Maybe we can consider that 4, the 4th conversation. And now the day of glory comes. Everybody gets together. Hey, we graduated from conversation to solution. We need to do that more. Now look, I understand there's things going on. I get it. I get it. I get that. But ladies and gentlemen, clocks are ticking. And I know you see it. I know you see it. I know you feel it. Things are not right in this country. They're not. So I want to thank all of you for joining me. A quick word about the new Class War Battlefield podcast. I'll be honest, ladies and gentlemen, I'm a little stuck. And I mean it. And I don't want to be, but I am. I'm not 100% sure what I'm going to do with the podcast. I have some ideas, but it's kind of, I'm stuck right now. And I'm stuck mainly because I have decided that I will produce and create another podcast, which is going to be dramatically different than CWB, but it's been one that I've wanted to do for a long time, and it's one that I need to do. Many of you may not know this, but a couple of years ago, I published a podcast for Class War Battlefield, and or an episode, so not a podcast, but an episode. In 2014, oh, 3 years ago, man, where did time go? But I included a recorded speech called Addressing Police Brutality and Violence in the Black Community. And though it was downloaded maybe, you know, maybe 30, 40 times, which is what this all averages, it was a passion, it was a labor of love, and I enjoyed it. And I have been I've been wanting to get into preaching for about 5 or 6 years, as you can tell kind of from what I do here, right? But I didn't just want to preach. I wanted to preach a specific word, a specific gospel, mostly social gospel. I'm not a liberal, I'm not a progressive, you know, I'm pretty resigned to the fact that I'm none of those things. I'm not a conservative, not a fascist, any of that crap. But I want to preach. And I believe the ancestors have a special plan for the planet, for me. And part of my debt to them for letting me come here and to be with all of you is to preach, is to show some of that great light that we need on this planet. And so part of the new podcast will be a platform for those sermons. I have been publishing, or I published last year actually, 3 kind of test run episodes, kind of gruffy. I did include three speeches on them. I want to record those speeches over again because it wasn't as good as they could have been, but what, you know, it's okay. First time out. I have another test episode coming out in about a month or so. It'll probably be the beginning of November. Before, sometime around the beginning of the year, I'm going to go live, you know, with the new podcast. And so, it is likely that Class War Battlefield will remain this way for a while as I stabilize that one. And then, as I said before, I have some ideas. I've written them down. I've actually written down an extensive outline for a possible structure for this new, for Class War Battlefield going into the future. But it is dramatically different than this, ladies and gentlemen. It is overwhelmingly different than this. And it's unlikely that I'm going to use it because I don't believe that it focuses enough. So when I do finally decide to publish this in a new format, it is still likely that periodically I will produce podcasts like this one. If you have any ideas on what you would like to hear, you know, don't hesitate to send me a message. Don't hesitate to send me a message on Facebook, on via my email. If you send it to my email, I'm more likely to get it. I'll be honest with you. So, until the next time, ladies and gentlemen, and you know, I'm gonna work hard to start putting these out a little bit more often again. Right now, I'm kind of resigned to doing them roughly once a month. As again, I go through the process of preparing for this podcast, this new podcast to come out. But who knows? You know, as things kind of evolve, I might end up doing more. All right. This is your brother, Vyamir Diesel. Oh, and quickly. I've thought about doing a couple of live editions of this podcast. You know, putting together something where, you know, you guys, if you wanted to, you could call in. We can have a little bit of a dialogue. But, you know, I'm not ready to do that yet. Most of what you're hearing, just to kind of give you a little bit of behind the scenes, as I'm kind of gathering my thoughts, sometimes I work off of notes, but most of the times I don't. I just kind of gather thoughts in my head throughout the week, and then I'll put it all down, you know, for you to hear on here. I did start doing notes and what have you at the beginning of the year. I kind of gotten away from it, though, but, so I do sometimes pause this. You might be able to hear it sometimes, but I do pause it and then come back up, and so, you know, I'm not ready to really host by myself a 45-minute to an hour-long show, but, you know, I might give that some further thought, especially because the new podcast that I'll be doing will be live. And it's, like I said, it's dramatically different. But I love my economics, so, you know, I'm wedded to this idea. I love Class War Battlefield Podcast, so, you know, I'm still going to be doing something with it, alright? So, peace to all of you. You know, this is a little bit of a rambler, but hopefully it helped you out. Peace to you all. Shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom. And we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.